Muriel. My parents divorced when I was 5 in 1958. Throughout my childhood and adolescence, my father faithfully came to visit every Saturday or Sunday. He was a steady presence in my life. My mother was Dad's second wife. His first was a Mexican-American woman named Juanita Tipper, about whom I know nothing. They were married briefly in the 1940s during World War II, when Dad was in training in San Diego. But the marriage was annulled a short time later. My father joked several times that the reason was that Juanita had cooked a rabbit he had given to her as a pet. I couldn't tell if he was kidding, and I didn't ask him. In 1959, my father married for the third and final time to Muriel Imbrie Kunstler. Muriel, whose nickname was Moo, was a Manhattan divorcee who had grown up on Park Avenue. Everyone agreed that she was exceptionally stylish, always beautifully dressed. She was funny and generous when sober, but wicked mean when drunk, when she had a mouth like a sailor. Unfortunately, she was drunk much of the time. Although an alcoholic himself for much of his life, my father was not an abusive one. He discovered Alcoholics Anonymous in the early 1970s and, as far as I know, never took another drink. Having worked for years in luxury retail, Muriel sensed I was gay before I did. She confronted me about it when I was 14. It was December 25th, 1967, at their annual Christmas Day party, for Jews mostly, in the living room of Dad and Moo's apartment on East 68th Street. Moo enjoyed referring to herself as the wicked stepmother, and she certainly was one that day, shouting across the living room past the dozen or so guests, the Christmas tree, the gifts near the fireplace, and into my corner. I was wearing a new navy blazer with gold buttons. She used my nickname. "Gabby," she screamed, "you are a fag. Did you hear me? Listen to me, Gabby." I said nothing, just gazed in her direction as she sat in a small upholstered chair near the chintz sofa. Oddly, I displayed no anger or signs of shame during her attack. I was numb. Soon, in that raspy smoker's voice, my sloshed stepmom went in for more, emphasizing the word fag in case anyone misunderstood. "Gabby, you're gay," she screamed. "I can tell. You don't know it yet, but I know many queens, and believe me, you are definitely a fag." The volume of conversations dropped, but the guests still chatted and managed to hear each other above her rant. Maybe they figured if they carried on determinedly, all of the unpleasantness would disappear. It did not. Finally, Muriel took a breath and paused, and by then all conversations in the room had ceased. I looked around, but no one met my gaze. They were looking here, there, and everywhere, but not at me. A longtime family friend, Alfred Gordon, approached my father, who was standing just a few feet away, holding on to his Dewar's rocks. Alfred leaned in and whispered, "Bernie, Muriel's riding kind of rough on Garrett." Could it be? Had Dad not noticed? Not heard any of it? Amazingly, I didn't think Dad had noticed. Over the years, he had become skilled at ignoring Muriel's drunken explosions. In an instant, though, he came to and shouted at her, "Knock it off, Muriel!" And he picked up a book of matches from the mahogany table next to him and flung the matches at her as hard as he could. They bounced off her shoulder, and if she felt them, she didn't let on. I figured she was too wasted to notice. Actually, Muriel was wrong when she said that I didn't know I was gay. I wasn't unaware of the feelings I was having about boys. I just wasn't sure what they meant. At 14, I was not prepared to have an honest conversation with myself about the meaning of my sexual attraction to other boys at school. Eventually, though, I came to suspect, deep down in my deepest heart, that yes, I was homosexual. After all, I would soon be in 10th grade, and girls still held no allure for me, boys did. My reactions in these sorts of scenarios were problematic. They were invisible. Even before puberty, A purposeless grin had become my default for processing trauma. Whenever I witnessed a fight of any kind, even an embarrassment or an awkward moment, I would simper hollowly, occasionally adding in the faint hope of smoothing things over what I hoped would read as a witty remark. I needed to reassure myself that no matter what ugliness had occurred, everything would turn out fine. At the time, I didn't realize that I was developing a pattern of reacting to trauma and conflict this way. My mantra seemed to be, "Don't panic, it's all right, everything will be normal again." I eventually realized that Muriel thought the words fag, gay, and queen were identical, and therefore interchangeable. After all, working at Henry Bendel on 57th Street, she'd been around homosexuals for years. In fact, there was usually a sprinkling of gay men at the gatherings that she and my father threw during the year. Some of those gents, especially the ones with artsy jobs, were markedly effeminate. They could afford to live out of the closet and did. But others, in more serious careers, attorneys and doctors and such, were confined by familial or cultural norms, often legally married to women, and decidedly more conventional in appearance and demeanor. These were the great undeclared, with no interest in living life in the sunlight. These were mostly the gay men I met growing up with my family in Manhattan. I quickly learned to categorize the queenie ones. I'd say to myself, "Oh, he's gay." I understood them, but those other more closeted men that my parents and step-parents knew did not seem a bit effeminate to me. In some cases, as I say, they were married, sometimes with kids. When they visited, usually on Sundays, they'd watch football with my dad and seemed in all ways regular guys. Those were the men living a lie, deeply in the closet to all but themselves. I didn't recognize it for a number of years. Despite all the progress toward societal acceptance, millions of men today still live their lives with a toxic lack of honesty. They still find it preferable to keep all parts of their sexuality hidden from the world. Daddy and Moo's apartment at 315 East 68th Street was unit number 12E, two bedrooms, two baths, a dining room, and kitchen. It was the unit occupied by the building's developer when 315 went up in 1931. It was lined with built-in bookshelves, glass brick, and indirectly lighted display spaces. The fireplace was real, and I enjoyed watching my father arrange logs in it on winter Sundays. Their books were serious hardcovers mostly, Steinbeck, Hemingway, Sinclair Lewis, New Yorker magazines. The upholstery was mostly chintz, polished cotton in bold, striking floral designs of the early 20th century. There were also fascinating objets, like large confrontational African masks, and vintage brass-fitted butler's tables of dark mahogany. All the serving pieces were in Muriel's pattern, Wedgwood's old castle. Fittingly, a large oval-shaped antique tray played a major role in lubricating social events here. Atop it stood fifths of Johnny Walker Red, Dewar's, Gilby's, Smirnoff, Beefeater, other distilled spirits, and a few decent reds. And in the refrigerator, always plenty of Rheingold Extra Dry Lager, a New York mainstay, and the first truly delicious beer I ever tasted. Ever the stylish one, Muriel became convinced it was only a matter of time before the world stampeded to blindingly bright home furnishings. She just knew it, intuiting it from perusing the trades, Fairchild rags mostly, like Women's Wear Daily and Home Furnishings Daily. Soon, the cream-colored walls in the living room were chartreuse. A boyfriend I brought there some years later pulled me aside and confided that the green in the room was so bright, he was nauseated. He was serious when he said that he was going to throw up. We left. Moo favored Rodier couture and big, extraordinary jewelry, so stylish that it defined her. She wore heaps of it. Her huge pearls shimmered. She carried her Chanel 255 daily, the classic double-flap black leather shoulder bag designed in 1955. It was the juxtaposition of that elegant appearance with her drunken outbursts that made Muriel Glaser unforgettable. For more than a decade, Muriel was part of the first floor team at Henri Bendel and its celebrated Street of Shops. At first, she ran the stationery department there, but was soon promoted to first floor merchandise manager, overseeing pretty much everything. In the late 1960s, she left Bendel's to open her own store, Folio 72, at Madison Avenue and 72nd Street, across from the old Rhinelander Mansion, which later became Ralph Lauren's flagship store in the U.S. It offered bookbinding, stationery, writing instruments, and assorted pricey stuff for the desk. I learned an important lesson working at Folio while in college. If an item didn't sell, Muriel did not mark it down. She marked it up. Usually that worked. Customers figured if an item was that expensive, it must be special. Folio did well despite Muriel's occasional thunderous spats with clients on matters of taste, loudly directing them to leave my store. In one such row after the client left, Mu announced to no one in particular, "If they have that kind of taste, I don't want them in here." Despite her neuroses and acute alcoholism, Muriel grew to become a respected force in the stationery industry, regarded as a true innovator. A growing number of her colleagues had high regard for her concepts. Personal notepads in brilliant colors, using craft stock for letterhead stationery, handsome note cards with witty sayings in huge type. All a far cry from the usual stuffy engraved vellum that had long been the standard in fine stationery. When she retired, Mu's best friend, Doris Blau, a thoroughly wonderful and prominent antique rug dealer, Doris Leslie Blau Gallery, 5 East 57th Street, the soul of the apartment is in the carpet. Doris organized an industry tribute to Muriel at the St. Regis Hotel. It was the week of the National Stationery Show at the Javits Center, so tout le monde de la papeterie was in town. I was there on the big night, and I heard a speaker say, "Mrs. Glaser changed this industry's design standards." And it was true. You could not simply dismiss her as an aggressive shrew. When I was 13, I casually mentioned to Muriel that my cousin Brian and I had gone into Tiffany & Company at 57th Street and 5th Avenue on one of our after-school jaunts. We had seen the huge Tiffany diamond they had on display, and we wanted more, so we checked out all the men's rings they had on display. Some looked very expensive. We thought they were cool. We got to chatting with the salesman there, who could not have been more patient with us. They did not mind our asinine questions like, "Are all sapphires blue?" or "Is there really such a thing as white gold?" It was then that I made the mistake of telling Muriel that Brian and I thought it might be cool to actually work at Tiffany, because then we'd be surrounded by beautiful objects every day. Well, that's when Mu started screaming at me, "No son of mine is gonna be a goddamn ring salesman at Tiffany." Whenever she was riled, she would switch from using stepson to just son. After I thought about it, I realized that I had breached what Muriel saw as a firm class boundary. She had long insisted that I was going to have a much more serious career than a job in retail. Of course, Muriel had worked in luxury retail for much of her adult life and done well at it, but to her, ring salesmen at Tiffany were basically showgirls, and worse, fags of a decidedly lower class. Who knew? Certainly not me. I'd never really thought about it. At the time, I didn't realize it, but it was the potential violation of two class boundaries that so riled her, gay and lower class. 5 years after my father's death in 1981, when I had worked my way back to New York and was anchoring a daily 5-minute entertainment news segment on WABC-TV's Channel 7, Eyewitness News, I'd occasionally visit Muriel and bring along my boyfriend at the time, Michael. One evening after work, we met her out for dinner at a Second Avenue cafe called The Beach at 70th Street. Muriel brought her friend Seema. When we walked in about 7 o'clock, Moo was already quite drunk. Our conversation soon turned to the high number of AIDS-related deaths in New York, much in the headlines in the early 80s, but even more so in 1987, just before the drug AZT was introduced in March that year. And she brought up the topic of staying safe. She asked loudly, "So what do you two do together? You'd better be staying safe." Well, Michael was unaccustomed to discussing this sort of thing with anybody, much less parent types. He slid down in his chair, actually so far down that only his eyebrows remained visible above the tablecloth. Moo asked, "You're oral, right? Do you suck each other's cocks? Are you cocksuckers?" "My Harold likes that," chimed in her friend Seema. Muriel replied, "I never met a man who didn't like it." I took all of this to mean that these two stylish New York broads, each now close to 70, was reveling in getting down and dirty with us young'uns. What they were really trying to show us was, aren't we modern? Muriel paused and then, without making eye contact with Seema, blurted out, "Actually, I always thought your Harold was a little on the faggy side." "What?" gasped Seema. "Harold's not that way, Muriel." "Well, I mean with those Gucci loafers," Moo continued, "and he wears red socks, too." Hardly prescient, but I could still tell that the exchange was not headed anywhere good, I saw an out. "We're going to head out, ladies. It was great seeing you tonight, and thank you for a swell dinner." Soon, we were home. Moo's tirade on Christmas Day 1967 was one of several over two decades that I endured at her hands. When sober, she would praise my intelligence or sense of humor or the performance of my characters like Victor the Puerto Rican hairdresser. I had a collection of stream-of-consciousness personalities I'd created at a young age, and they were entertaining if stereotypical. Sometimes being the center of attention, being on, just felt comfortable to me. Moo once confided after I'd offered some truth or other about a friend's neuroses, "Garrett, you're unusually insightful for a boy your age." But as I've pointed out, when drunk, Moo could turn brutal. People who witnessed those moments always sat quietly and let her finish. Rarely did anyone interrupt Muriel. My father occasionally confronted her, but it was never enough to stop her from behaving heartlessly, like the time she berated my father's best friend, Phil Doyle, at the dining table. Phil's elegant wife, Mary Ann, had passed away a month earlier, cancer. Phil was really missing her, and he had mentioned her several times over dinner. Suddenly, Muriel exploded at him and screamed, "Oh, shut up about Mary Ann. I'm sick of hearing her goddamn name." For good measure, she slammed the large serving tray onto the table and then got up to go into the kitchen, ordering as she left, "Talk about something else." Phil began bawling loudly. My father tried to comfort him. It wasn't until years later, while at the office of my psychotherapist, that I realized something important. As loving and steadfast as my father could be, he failed to protect me from his crazy wife. In his pre-AA years, Dad's inaction was understandable to me, but long after he worked the program and stopped drinking, my father continued to tolerate the significant verbal and emotional abuse I suffered thanks to Muriel. He was somehow never there to nip it in the bud. I don't think Dad's passivity was intentional. It was just easier to make believe she wasn't there. In the 1990s, living in Southern California, by then a decade after my father's death, I occasionally returned to New York to do a story. Sometimes I'd visit Muriel at the apartment. On one visit, which had actually been going well, she seemed to come out of nowhere with, "You know, Garrett, it wasn't the cancer that killed your father. It was your being gay." Well, I had matured enough by that time to no longer feel intimidated by Muriel. In fact, I still loved her enough to honor her with the truth. I said, "Well, if that's true, Muriel, if it was that important to him, I'd say he didn't have much of a life, did he?" I asked calmly. Muriel was shocked. "How dare you say that about your father?" But I chose not to engage. Strangely, given her fag-baiting, I don't think Muriel was trying to be nasty. She was expressing what she actually believed, deluded as it was. I loved my dad and thought he had lived an amazing life. I knew he was proud of me, and he frequently said as much. From my difficult relationship with Muriel, as well as from earlier distressing incidents in my teenage years, I learned something. I could file away memories of life's confrontational moments in their own drawer. I grew skillful at pretending they had never occurred. Being laughed at on the baseball field or called fairy boy on the school bus became distant memories. It was only after years of therapy, which I had initiated with great skepticism, that I began to think about how the clashes with my father's wife affected me. At long last, I disabused myself of the notion that there had not been any long-term psychological impact. Those moments were indeed a force in my life, traumatic episodes that marked me. By the time I graduated from high school, I understood the importance of standing my ground, of believing in myself, and of refusing to disappear into the sad twilight world of the homosexual, as Mike Wallace so sweetly put it in CBS's infamous 1967 primetime documentary, CBS Reports, The Homosexuals. I knew early on that I would refuse to live a life of secrecy. Too much trouble. Even at 14, I realized I was a good person, smart, kind, resilient. I slowly came to realize that I was deserving of respect in the world, even if I couldn't get it from my stepmother.